Hello, everybody. Welcome to the newest episode of the Diecast Movie Podcast. And normally, the episodes are decided by the roll of a die where a die is cast, and that decides the genre we picked a movie, or we do interviews. But we're doing something a little different for 14 episodes of the Diecast, which are going to be starting now and come out during the next couple of years, and that is a Sam Peckinpah retrospective series. We're going to do all 14 movies that he was the lead director of. So maybe if we're feeling up to it, we might hit some of the other ones that he had either wrote the script or did some other directing. I don't know. But right now, we're focusing on the main 14, and we're not doing them in chronological order. We're not starting with two of his big known films like The Wild Bunch or The Getaway. We're starting with Junior Bonner, and I'm joined with Ansel Farage, filmmaker extraordinaire, whose recent film, Todd Tarantula, is available for purchase on Blu-ray and Amazon, or you can stream it for free. But hey, help support your independent filmmakers and buy the Blu-ray. Get the extras that are on there, because there's lots of extras. How you doing today, Ansel?
I'm good. Thank you so much for having me, Stephen.
It's always a pleasure to have you on here, and I know you've been a busy man working on your latest project, which you're getting nearer and nearer to the finish line. Do you want to tell anybody about it?
Yeah, we've been since April. We started pre-production in March, but been filming since the start of April. It's a comedy that we've been working on for nearly a decade called The Great Nick D. And it is about a washed-up porn star, Nick D, who has become a Venice Beach nobody, but then decides to restart his mainstream acting career in order to win back the his lost love, who is now an Oscar-nominated actress. And it's a huge ensemble film. We have David Selby, Catherine Lee Scott, Olan Jones, Lisa Richards, Sam Irvin, Laura Parker, Jerry Lacey makes a cameo. Nathan Wilson plays Nick D. It's a big dramatic comedy, and it was so much fun to make. I'm really excited to finally share it some point next year. We're still in post-production editing and all of that. It's been a nice, fun experience, and it's been good to do an independent film during the midst of a Hollywood crisis.
And I will say, I think Catherine Lee Scott was telling you this is one of your, she's been in a few of your movies, and she thinks this is your best production, you know, going from the, if I understand from what I've heard, that she thinks this is your best movie to date production-wise and everything else. Obviously, she hasn't seen the finished product. Nobody has. Is that true?
She had a lot of fun, and Catherine is a perfectionist, but she had great difficulty in keeping a straight face through a couple scenes, and that includes a musical number. So, it was a lot of fun to make. And I'm really excited to share it next year, more than likely, with everybody. And it's more in line with my film Will and Liz than it is Loon Lake. So, yeah.
And you know, I love Will and Liz, so it's a nice dramedy, and I was really into it. And I know Nate Wilson does an excellent job. I'm really looking to see how much scenery Sam Irvin chews and how much he steals from everybody, you know, doing his cameo. I'm really curious to.
Oh, it's not even a cameo. It's not even a cameo. It's a critical role.
Don't spoil it.
It's Sam, but it's very not your normal colorful Sam. So that's what I'll say. I'll let everybody be surprised when the film comes out. But yeah, it's not a cameo. He's got a major sequence. So yeah.
Awesome.
And that was really fun. I called up Sam and I said, hey Sam, so you know, Steven Spielberg had David Lynch in The Fablemans. I need you to be my David Lynch. And we had a good laugh on the phone about that. But no, it was a pleasure to direct Sam, and this was his first acting role. And, you know, primarily he is a film director, so it was a little daunting. Of okay, I'm a director directing another director, but and I think he was nervous of okay, now I have to act, but it was a fun day. So yeah.
I'm looking forward to it. It's I love David Selby. I love Catherine Lee Scott. I love Nate Wilson. I'm really looking forward to, because Sam Irvin's in it, because you and I are good friends with Sam. So, you know, it's like one of those things when you have a buddy that you know in the movie, you really want to see. And now you're telling me his part's even bigger than I was imagining it. Oh, it's like, oh. And then I'll see Sam at Monster Bash and get him to sign it. It's like, Sam, sign it, sign it.
You're right, right, yeah. And Olan Jones, she's the one that steals parts. She's of course, she was in Edward Scissorhands and The Truman Show and Miracle Mile, and kind of known her for about 10 years as well. And so I offered her another major role in the film, and she said yes. And she steals roles. She steals scenes, I should say. Her role is really funny. And she was constantly throwing out ideas and crazy things that hadn't thought of, you know, during the writing that she then did on set. And she steals the movie from Sam. So, and it was a real honor to have her, to have her, you know, join our ensemble. It's, you know, it's more than just the Dark Shadows troupe. It's a bigger cast, and also the supporting cast. I don't even call them a supporting cast, but all the other players in the film, everybody brought their A game, I think this one's really special. Really special movie.
I'll say, you have Doug Eames is in this one too, right?
Yeah. Oh yeah. And I kind of don't want to say anything about his character, but he's really funny too. Not at all the commanding father presence in Todd Tarantula. Is the total opposite in this Venice Beach kook.
Oh, I'm sure it's a role he's probably been waiting to do. It's like, I get to play the kook. Yes. You know, actors always have their certain roles. It's just like, they know they can run with it and have fun with it. And I'm sure he did.
Yeah.
And hopefully this will be coming out sooner than later. I know you're in the editing stage and you got a daunting task there, because it's always, I know I hate editing. I know for filmmakers, this is where you get to take all the puzzle pieces and put them together to make the picture that you want. And then but unlike when we put jigsaw puzzles together, you have extra pieces and you got to figure out which pieces belong and which ones don't. So you have the, which some filmmakers love to do, some don't. I think you're one that actually enjoys the challenge of trying to make that work, even though it's always hard. But I think you enjoy it a little bit.
Yeah, it's case-by-case basis. It's case-by-case. This one was shockingly easier to assemble than past films, but I think it's because it's not an effects movie. It's very much a human character driven film, so everything was kind of there. I didn't have to deal with rotoscoping or crazy, you know, visual effects, but it's a big film. We want to get it done right, and we also want to have it come out when the strikes have been settled, so that we can all properly discuss the film. I've been, you know, in between, or as soon as we wrapped production, I've been out protesting outside of Amazon, who have screwed me over, to put it bluntly, as an independent filmmaker, very ruthlessly. I also been outside of Warner Brothers and mostly Amazon. Amazon is, I've got, you know, they're the ones that carry my films, and it's not cool at all what they've been doing to us creators and us artists. And So we want to have been editing and but the film won't come out until next year, and hopefully the strikes will get resolved by the AMPTP before then. Luckily, since we are an independent production, we are not affiliated with the AMPTP, and our Screen Actors Guild paperwork was approved long before the strikes began and carried on with because it is not a theatrical contract. We were able to conclude shooting during the strikes, so you know, if we independent filmmakers can provide what the guilds are asking for on that level, but SAG, there's no excuse at all with these huge corporate entities that do not care and don't want to give actors and writers and us filmmakers what we rightly deserve. So yeah, I could rant very long about this, but I'll keep my mouth shut.
I'll just say I'm going to agree with you because in a lot of ways, a lot of people always think about these things with Hollywood only being the big stars, you know, the guys that are, you know, with the name people, which everybody knows, you know, it's the ones that are making multiple millions of dollars. But it's like sports, like baseball, Major League Baseball. That's like 1% of the people that are in the industry have a chance of even making that money or making it to the big leagues. And then that group, a small percentage make the big, big bucks. And then you got all the other people that play in the sports that are in the different leagues that do it for the love of it and they want to make a living on doing it. And then you got, unlike in sports, well, you do have owners there too, but it seems to be a little bit better revenue sharing going on. You have people that are just like, okay, we'll give you a penny per viewing or something like that. And it's just
pretty much a penny. Yeah.
A penny. And you're making nothing. That's why I said earlier on, buy the Blu-ray. If you really want to support independent filmmakers, I know you've heard me say this many times, buy the Blu-ray, they get a extremely higher percentage of that. And that helps they can invest into the next film and things like that. Cause a lot of these filmmakers, they're doing these independent projects. This is not their primary income. They're doing this on, this is like secondary, tertiary. Actually, if they're lucky to even make an income on it, it's just basically it for the love.
We're using our primary income to make this and to make these films. And there is no money in streaming. We're not making money on streaming. The system has to change and hopefully it will for the better.
I think it should. And I'm totally supporting you guys in that respect. I want the independent filmmakers to get paid their share because you are the bulk of the streaming movie that they have out there, you know, and the things like that. That they rely on to keep the new programming and things like that. And if you want to have better movies, they should invest in you guys, and then you'll get a better product, which will in turn make their side get more views. So it'll end up winning in that. So it's a win-win situation. It could easily be. Right now, they just want it all. Which it kind of brings us into the movie in a weird sense, because Junior Bonner is, you know, just one of the themes before we get in the movie proper is about how things change and it's more corporate greed in a sense into it. So it's kind of very similar, you know, in some aspects. It's a stretch a little bit, but it is in some ways as I transition this over. But when I asked you what movie you wanted to do with the Sam Peckinpah part, I gave you a bunch of different people, a list of the 14 movies. You picked this one. And, what was one of your reasons for picking it?
It's an untraditional Sam Peckinpah movie in that it's not one of his gory, not that I have any problem with gore, not one of his violent, hard-edged films. It's more of a quiet, almost documentary type of work. I do love The Getaway. I do love Bring Me the Head of Alfredo Garcia. Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid is brilliant, especially in its longer cut. This is a much more quiet, relaxed. It's the antithesis of Straw Dogs, and it's just unusual in that aspect. And also, it's a very tight film. It's very simple and straightforward. It's a very clean 3-act. Film. It mostly takes place in a day, really, 4th of July in Prescott, Arizona, and also the Blu-ray was going out of print. Kino Lorber put out a really great Blu-ray last year, or well, a couple years ago, and then last year the Blu-ray went out of print, so I wanted to snatch it up, and it was a good excuse to talk about it.
And luckily, you messaged me about it's going out, get it, and I was able to get one of the I said two copies left. I mean,
yeah.
Like, okay. otherwise, I would have trouble watching it. I'm not sure. I haven't checked to see if it's available on streaming. I'm sure it probably
it's not.
Nope, nope, streaming.
It's not. Nope.
Well, listeners, I hate to say that to you, but eventually, the one good news, if it's not on streaming now, if you pay, if you check every so often, it usually will pop up somewhere along the line.
Honestly, I don't believe many of Peckinpah's films are streaming, even The Wild Bunch and The Getaway. I feel like The Wild Bunch was on HBO Max for a moment before Powers That Be decided to screw around with HBO Max. But most of his work is kind of physical media based, and all the more excuse to go buy them. Then you have them, and then they can't be censored. Anyway.
Oh, I agree with you. Now,
Junior Bonner.
For listeners wondering, Junior Bonner, I knew nothing about the film, you know, except the title, and had Steve McQueen. But Steve McQueen plays an aging rodeo star who is basically nearing the end of his career, where he's going to be a person that can actually pull off wins and that kind of stuff. And the rodeo circuit ends up going back to his hometown, and he gets a chance to do the rodeo right there. Will it be his last hurrah? Will this be his last rodeo? Will he win? That's basically the movie, if you're looking at that part. But it also goes a lot into his family, his dad, his brother, his mom, all that kind of stuff, going on what's been happening in their relationship, because he's more of a vagabond because he's always traveling. And as I mentioned earlier, it's also showing you the sign about how rural areas are being taken over and urbanized, and how you have basically the idyllic life being changed into the more modernization. Let's make money. Let's make money. Greed, greed, greed. That kind of stuff is also an underlying theme of the movie too. But for those that have not seen the movie, that is a summarization without spoiling it. And I think we can go over a lot of the stuff, but we just won't tell you how he does in the rodeo at the end. I think we can leave that as a mystery for people. So that way, I don't think that's going to spoil. It won't spoil the movie, but I think even if we talk about these different things, because the acting is so strong and the family life is so prevalent, I don't think it's in that part we can really spoil it, because the acting is superb.
Yeah, yeah. That's not actually something else I really liked about it, is that it is, ultimately, it's a father-son story. The family drama is, I rewatched it during the production of Nick D, because there were several themes that kind of overlapped in The Great Nick D. So it was kind of a good excuse to also to revisit it then, of a broken down hero dealing with the changing of times and an unfamiliar future, and going to the father-son relationship between Robert Preston and Steve McQueen is the heart of the film. And it's just a nice little untraditional Sam Peckinpah thing. So yeah, I don't. Well, I can ramble again. So Stephen, you jump in and you give plot points and specific topics, and I can.
I'm going to jump in and tag on one of the things you just said. I didn't know Robert Preston was in this film, but like I said, I was going into it virtually. I didn't look at Wikipedia or IMDb. I went into it blind. And here I'm watching the opening credits, and I see Robert Preston's name there. Now, I don't know if you've probably seen it. Well, you've seen a lot of films. But I love Robert Preston for two main films. All right? The Last Starfighter, which I think was his last film.
Yeah.
And I saw that, oh my God, in the 80s. I had that thing on VHS and DVD. I think I saw it. I must have seen that thing 50, 60 times growing up. With Catherine Mary Stewart. Oh. But Robert Preston coming in there as the song and dance man, you know, who has that charm. And of course, probably the role that most people know him for, the Music Man.
Yep. Yeah. I forgot he was in Last Starfighter. That's totally right. Yeah. I always think of him as the Music Man as well. But yeah, he's Junior Bonner's father. He's just as broken down, if not more so, than Junior. He's unfaithful, philandering. Junior Bonner's mom is played by the great Ida Lupino. And there's a Robert Preston, he's just screwing around with everybody, particularly the nurse that was taking care of him at the hospital in the first half of the film. And one of my favorite moments is they're in the saloon in Prescott, and everybody's in there, and he's about to dance with the nurse, and Joe Don Baker, who plays Junior's greedy brother, and Junior, Steve McQueen, they both stand there and they say, isn't it always a rule to dance with mom first? And so then Robert Preston and Ida Lupino share in this little scene where they're dancing in the saloon. And you get the sense that, like, he still loves her and she still loves him in spite of all the difficulties and trials and tribulations that they've gone through in their relationship. But it's all very just subtle, and nothing is soap opera about the movie, which is, I mean, not that you would expect Sam Peckinpah to make something of a soap opera, considering how brutal and aggressive his films are. But it's just like, it's real. And that's what I loved about it. The film as a whole is a documentary piece on the 4th of July proceedings in Prescott, its parade and its annual rodeo. And most of it is genuine. Most of it is real. They really filmed it at the time. And the extras are a genuine residents of Prescott. So everything is natural and sort of fly on the wall filmmaking. And then you have this human drama that's interspersed throughout. And the human drama is just as real as the real life goings on. And another favorite scene of mine is when Steve McQueen gets on the back of Robert Preston's horse and they're riding in the parade together as father and son. And it's like, you can imagine him as a little boy and Robert Preston as the dad, younger, but like still his father, like, and this is them still doing this now 30 some years later. And then they're riding through the back of the town, just like riding like crazy. And it's just like it's as if they've always been father and son. It's just so natural. But Robert Preston, yeah, his dream is to move to Australia and herd sheep. And he's broke. And he asks Steve McQueen for money, and Steve McQueen is broke. And that's all that he wants to do. So that's kind of the motivation of the film and why Steve McQueen then does various things that he does in the film to help his dad out. And I love that. And
I don't know if that's the full motivation. It's the motivation for near the end.
There's a couple motives, but that's the driving force within the family drama of like.
Oh, true. I'm agreeing with you on that. I'm agreeing with you with that part. I'm just saying it's for decisions that he made were done prior to him finding out about his dad wanting to go to Australia. For instance, the
right.
You know, so some things were set up a certain way.
Him and his brother.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and those kind of things. And then when he found out, then he decided, because his brother wasn't going to help him, even though his brother is going to be making tons of money off basically just stealing land from his father for getting it for $15,000 when it was 600 acres, and he knows it's worth more. Yeah. And
it starts off with Steve McQueen rolling into the old house and seeing it being bulldozed by his brother's company. And that's like a perfect metaphor for the film of like his old way of life is being destroyed and obliterated by this newfound post-60s world of greed and development. And his brother is basically destroying what's left of the family and does not care about the family. And then there's that great dinner scene where everybody's sitting around the table and Steve McQueen finally just like throws a really great jab at him and knocks him over. And you're kind of waiting and plotting it to happen. There's also, I'm going off top, not off topic, but I'm getting all excited here. You have Barbara Lee, who was at one point, she was Vampirella for the announced Hammer Films movie that never got made. And she is kind of the love interest, as much as this movie can really get into a love interest for Steve McQueen. So some of the things that he's doing is to impress her too. But it's like The Getaway. It's a very quiet relationship, except he's not slapping her around the way that he slapped Ally McGraw around in The Getaway, and she's just like totally into it, and as is he. There's a lot of little subplots going on running through the film, kind of almost like in a Robert Altman-esque way. But it's so tight. It's I believe it's like 93 minutes. So everything is very quick and compact, but never rushed. Like it feels all the way things play out. It's just, as I keep saying, it's all just very natural.
Oh, and I think that's one of the nice things in the movie. And the movie picks up. It does start with the opening credits where you see Steve McQueen's last rodeo. So you get to see that. And then, yeah. And then it's traveling from that to his hometown. But you're right, most of it, the vast majority of the movie takes place like in a day-ish, I think like 2-day period, like 24 hours. You can look at it.
Yeah. Yeah.
It takes place in a very short time span. But what I love about the movie is it lets you figure things out for yourself. Because you're started in, a lot of movies nowadays, to me, that are poorly directed or maybe poorly written or both, they got to explain these things, or maybe they just assume the audience is stupid, and they got, oh, we got to explain every little thing, even though it's obviously there. And to me, Sam Peckinpah is shown with this film is that you're a storyteller. And you're using the visual medium to do that so you can show instead of tell and trust your audience to be able to figure out the crumbs. Everything is there for you to interpret it, you know, the proper way in order to do story. Or you might interpret things a slightly different way, but you're still able to keep the storyline going because everybody has their own preconceived notions coming in when they see certain things. But I think it's so smartly directed and also written by Jeb Rosebrook. You know, but the two of them obviously did very well together. And as you mentioned earlier, the only violence in this is the barroom brawl and the one punch that early on that Steve McQueen's character, J.R. Jr., does to Curly, you know, at the house thing. I mean, if you're looking for violence, if people are looking for violence, that's about it. But that's not Sam Peckinpah violence. Brawl, that's like Disney's violence.
Yeah, the barroom brawl is really more comic. It's not a serious Sam Peckinpah kind of fight. It's more like amusing and purposefully so. It's just the antithesis of a Sam Peckinpah film.
I love that brawl. We got to talk about the brawl. I mean, because there are some things that Steve McQueen just shows how good he is at setting things up with his body language, acting, and things like that. When he's dancing, because basically him dancing with, Charmaine, the girl, Barbara Lee, sets the whole thing up because she has a jealous boyfriend. You're allowed one dance, and they do the one dance, and then they start to do the second dance, and he sees the jealous boyfriend coming, and Red kept wanting to get involved in the dance, and he's like, no, it's my one dance. And Red's dancing next to him, oh, you want to cut in? You can cut in. And then the jealous boyfriend pushes Red. He's like, you can't do this. And next thing you know, the fight's going. And he goes right back to dancing with her. And he keeps moving her away from the brawl, moving her away to get her the alone
into
time.
The phone booth.
Yes.
Yeah.
It is. And that part is funny, as I'll get it, because the way he's able to set everything up. I was watching with my son, Ben, and we both were laughing hysterically at that scene, you know, because you knew it was coming. Yeah, you could see it coming a mile away, but it sold so well by both actors.
Yeah.
You know, by Red, who was played by Bill McKinney. They sold so well.
And even the way that Peckinpah directs it, it's just like, I mean, that must have taken, I would think, that would take, like, days to get and to all the coverage and the choreography but it's so like expertly handled and there's absolute mayhem is breaking loose in that bar, and McQueen remains just so calm and like unfazed by everything, and that just adds to the humor of it all. But yeah, it goes on for like, it's like a 10-minute sequence all the way into the phone booth, and everybody is still beating the crap out of each other while they're in the phone booth. But yeah, it's just it's one of the highlights of the movie. It's almost like the whole second half of the film is in that saloon. Yeah.
Oh, it's great. I don't know who the actor was, but the bouncer. I think he was the bouncer. That big hulking guy, and I love it where he's carrying one guy like a rag doll in his left arm, and he's still, you know, doing the stuff with his right arm, and then he goes to the band and he goes, play something patriotic, and they play the Star Spangled Banner, and everybody stands up and starts, you know, covering the hearts. It stops the fight, and I thought that was funny as I'll get it. You know, it's like pick something patriotic. This guy knew what he was doing.
Yeah, pure Americana.
and also you had Robert Preston's character Ace and Elvira, or Ellie as they called her, the mom. They were in a booth, and every time the fight would get near, they were just like, and he had the dog, which that only liked Ace, or Robert Preston's character, keeping people away. It's like, oh, you know, he doesn't fight clean, you know.
Right. Yeah, it's a very it's expertly handled, and half of those people had to have been like actual residents too, like that had just practiced and prepared. It's so documentarian, as I keep repeating myself. But yeah, it's a great scene. There's not much action in the film overall. There is the couple rodeo scenes and then this brawl, but everything else is just quiet human connection scenes.
And I love the rodeo scenes because they're the very, like I said, the opening credits, they're showing you some of that. And then they have...
And they're establishing how beat up and broken Steve McQueen's character, JR, is, because he is at the end of the line. He can't, if he does another, he'll almost kill himself, but just how bruised and his body is just broken, and he's wrapping himself and trying to just mend himself, but he does not care because he's Steve McQueen. He's just cool.
And also, he rides the bull Sunshine, which is, you know, of course, a terror, even though it's called Sunshine, and he gets thrown before the 8 seconds pass. And if people want to see bull riding, you can watch the PBR, Professional Bull Riding. They go around, they do tours. I remember taking the kids to it, see it one time years ago, and they pop up on the cable channels. So if you want to see what the real thing's like, you can see that they did a lot of accurate filming in the scenes with it. But during the movie, he keeps flashing back. So he has that little post-traumatic stress, you know, going on with that. And, with that bull, but he wants to ride the bull again, which he makes the deal with, Buck, who's, oh my God, Ben Johnson. I mean, who's done a lot of films for Sam Peckinpah.
Peckinpah.
But Ben Johnson's in it playing the guy who's running the circuit, and everybody's usually paying not to ride Sunshine. And of course, Junior does the opposite. He's basically paying to ride Sunshine because he's not sure if this is going to be his final time. And he wants to, if he does it, he wants to go out, you know,
with a bang. Prove himself to everybody, hey, I'm just as good as my dad, if not better. And then for several other reasons to bring back his family's dignity and some kind of respect, to give his dad to fulfill his father's dream of the Australia thing, to give it to his brother, to impress Barbara Lee. There's numerous things that are going on with that single bull ride, and to prove to himself of like, I'm not done. Even if he knows deep down he really can't go on much longer. He's fighting against the changing of the tide.
Father Time always wins in the end. And I think I agree with you, a lot of all those were like objectives, but I think it started off with the first objective being to prove it to himself, because that's when he brokers the deal with Ben Johnson or Bert. And then the other stuff all comes once he finds out what's going on, and all have a play in the character. And which I love, because it starts off with one reason, and that might not be enough, but then these other reasons start to kick in, and it plays out in a way where it just builds up, which is part of real life. You know, you start off doing something for one reason, and next thing you know, multitude of other reasons start to come into play, and the next thing you know, it becomes, or on the other hand, sometimes you have a main reason to do something and something changes and that's no longer an important issue. And that's why sometimes you'll see a project die on the vine, even though you listeners won't know. But you'll see things like this project is coming and something happens that you don't know about and probably never will. And that's the reason that project never bore any fruit. So the opposite could happen also. But what did you think of Ben Johnson? I mean, as an actor in this, I thought he was doing the whole thing.
When does Ben Johnson ever give a bad performance? It's like he's and plus he's part of Sam Peckinpah's regular cast of characters. I mean, he's a little skeevy, a little bit, but he's not like a total asshole. And as I said, I mean, when does he ever give a bad performance? He is that character in the film. You forget that is Ben Johnson, just like you forget that is Ida Lupino, you know, great British starlet. She's just this rundown mom living in a rundown farmhouse. Everybody is just like they disappear into their roles. And even McQueen, like, even though it's Steve McQueen and he's got that movie star magnetism that Ryan Gosling will never have, and I do like Ryan Gosling, they all are these people that are just broken and dirty and living in this real-life town. That's just the whole uniqueness of this film. It's not as stylized as Peckinpah's other films can be and are. It's just presenting things as humanly as possible without the movie star glow of several of these players.
And for listeners that aren't familiar with Ben Johnson, because I know there's some younger people that are not, you're a younger person, but you're a film enthusiast.
They don't know who Robert Preston is or what the Music Man is, let alone Ben Johnson.
Well, there are people that don't know. I mean, I remember I used to work at a college and it's amazing. You know, but you talk to people in their 20s and you mention something that's like somebody from just 20 years prior, they look at you like, what? Except every so often you do get the one that knows. But he was a rodeo. He used to be on the circuit. He used to be a rodeo performer. This is a guy that used to do all these things. Was in tons of John Wayne movies. As you said, Sam Peckinpah regular. But also, for those that like to look at, he's in smaller budget ones too. Like he was in The Town That Dreaded Sundown, he brought excellent work regardless of the film. You know, you never mailed it in. You still enjoyed his performance.
He won the Oscar for The Last Picture Show and he was great in that. It's a heartbreaking movie. The Town That Dreaded Sundown. When did Ben Johnson ever give a bad performance? He never did. And he was always of that old school form of I don't want to call it tough guy acting, but he was always just like, this is me. I'm just being myself and funneling myself through the pages of this script in the same manner of Bogart and Cagney and John Wayne to a degree and Steve McQueen. We don't have actors like that anymore. We just don't. Harrison Ford, but even he's of two generations ago. Timothy Chalamet is not that. Like that's, we don't have those guys.
Well, you never know. Eventually, when things disappear, somebody else will come in and they'll fill the void. We just haven't found the next person yet. But I'm sure somebody will come into play. You know, because things do go in cycles, and eventually somebody will come back.
Not to go completely off topic, I mean, on that note, you know, I was thinking, I watched this past summer, I watched a bunch of, you know, classic films to, you know, keep my head in the great Nick D. I really wanted to bring a sense of just like feel good classic Hollywood filmmaking, and a good many of those movies, you know, starred Clark Gable. And I was watching him and I'm like, we do not have a Clark Gable at all. Like even in the second wave of actors of Paul Newman, C. McQueen, Robert Redford, there's no one has picked up the mantle of Clark Gable. Like these guys, sometimes they are just one and done. Like, I cannot name an actor today working that comes near the effortless magnetism and tough guy brawn of Clark Gable that can do kind of almost any genre. So yeah, as far as like a Ben Johnson type, a Steve McQueen type, we don't have them. We have a lot of pretty boys. I will say.
Well,
Brad Pitt and Leo are of an older generation too. They're not, you know, they're my generation. The Tom Holland, no, man, he's Spider-Man. Like, sorry.
There are times, and then we'll move off this topic. It's male or female actor. Like, you'll see them, and they all look the same. And you look at him, he's like, is that this person or that person? Because they all look the same. They sound the same. It's basically that same type. And you don't see as much as where the old Warner Brothers cartoons, where they could do a caricature of somebody, Edward G. Robinson, or as you already mentioned, Humphrey Bogart, Peter Lorre, tons of people. And they could just do, or Groucho Marx, they could come in and you knew right away who they were just by the walk, a look in the face, the way they turned a phrase or an accent, and you knew right away that personality. Nowadays, it's just kind of like, I agree with you. But bringing it back, it's like Ida Lupino, thank you. I was butchering it.
Okay.
Is another one of those, though. You know, when you see her, you're drawn right in her performances. Yeah. And I just thought it was something nice to see, which I didn't know, but her and Robert Preston are roughly the same age in this film, because they're both born in the same year. You know, give or take, they're a few months apart or whatever. I didn't look at the exact, you know, match the exact birthday. I looked at the years. I was like, wow, you don't, but even then, you don't usually see a male partner with the same age female. You know, it's rare. And to see that then and there was amazing. You know, to see it work so well.
Yeah, yeah. And I believe Sam Peckinpah used to rent Ida Lupino's back house or guest house way back when he first came out to Hollywood. And so, like, giving her this role was returning the favor. So I thought that was nice too. And also, we have to remember, Ida Lupino was one of the great female filmmakers at a time that Hollywood did not allow that. I mean, yes, we had Lois Weber and several others in the early dawn of Hollywood, but like, you had Ida Lupino directing major television. She had a great film noir in The Hitchhiker. And she was a director to be reckoned with in her own right. So, it's just, and seeing her, you know, it's a couple years before she appeared in The Food of the Gods, but at least this film gives her some dignity and a good role to, like, chow down on. And again, it's a quiet role. It's a quiet performance. A lot of it is conveyed with looks, glances, but she's a critical performer in the film, and you feel for her. And you get her pain and frustration, but you also get that she understands the world that she is living in, her character is living in, and that this is just the way things are. So I might as well make the best of it.
What I also loved about her performance was with her and Robert Preston. The chemistry the two of them had on screen was just amazing. Yeah. And the scene after the barroom brawl, where they're going up the stairs, like talking on the stairs, and the dialogue between the two of them is just, you could see he's the dreamer. She's like, oh, but you always are doing these dreams, and they never come true, because he wants her to come to Australia. She doesn't want to go because she knows it'll probably end up not working out and all this stuff. And also, you know, you think about it, you also don't want to leave your grandkids. Yeah,
right. Right.
I can see there's a lot of reasons.
You feel that they have a very long, colorful history together, that they've lived these lives, even though, you know, they're just acting. And it's just, I keep saying, the realism and the naturalness of this film. And everybody just brings that.
And also the dialogue was written so well. What was the line? It was where she says that when he asked about her going to Australia, she says something like, I wouldn't go to Australia with you. I wouldn't even go to hell with you. And I think he responds back, well, they're both down under.
That's right.
And that Robert Preston, you know, sales pitch style that, you know, that's built for his personality, the music man type, the Last Starfighter, where he's using that same personality to sell you something, to sell you that dream, yeah. to sell you the con man. If a man, an actor was ever born to play a role type and got matched beautifully with it, this is the man, that's the role. And if he was still alive, you'd still be putting him as the con man, because you'd be like, con man, Preston, is he available? Yes, hire, boom, we're right. done.
Yeah. I agree. And again, we don't have actors like him where the versatility, he can do big Broadway musical and then he can do gritty. I kind of hesitate to call this a Western. It is, but it's a drama. But to jump back and forth and be totally convincing and be totally believable. And you forget that was the Music Man. He's this old cowpoke rodeo salesman in that sense. Yeah,
exactly. And I find it funny. We haven't really talked about Steve McQueen. We've mentioned them like different things, but you know, it shows you how good this movie is with the cast and how they're all getting spots when we're not just focusing on the star.
Yeah.
And we've mentioned this other actor, Joe Don Baker, a little bit. But, you know, I think it's amazing what he does with Curly, you know, because he's got a physical presence, you know, and of course, this is before he did Walking Tall, which a lot of people remember him from that's based on a real life story. I'm using air quotes because you always wonder how much of it is real and how much it's not. But I enjoy Walking Tall. And you know, we're not talking about the Dwayne Johnson one. We're talking about the one in the 70s, people, you know, for people that don't remember.
Yeah, the real independent made one, yeah.
But he was also in Guns of the Magnificent Seven. So he was, you know, in a lot of different films where he was in Westerns and he was in real-life small-town type things. So he fits in with this role so well as a brother who cares, but he's going about it in a different way. I don't want to make him look like he's evil for, like, yes, he did.
He's selfish. He's in it for his own interest.
He's in it for his own interest, but he also is taking care of the mom, and he did say he would take care of the dad. He's making sure he's coming out ahead of all in all these deals.
Yeah.
But
exactly.
But it's not like he's a total a-hole where he's like, I'm going to take this all from you and give you guys nothing and leave you destitute. So he is trying to do something there. So I want to... Yes, he is probably the most, I guess you could say he's the antagonist of the film, you know, but it's not really that kind of film though.
Yeah. It's human. It's not like there's going back to even Ben Johnson, who is kind of, his character can be a little skeevy, but everybody is real. They're all like complex human people. Joe Don Baker, he is the obstacle in one of the obstacles in the way, but he's not a total creep. He is selfish and self-absorbed, but he's also has like, yeah, he also does, like you just said, he does care and he has his own way of doing things. They're not the way that Steve McQueen would do them. And it was originally, I think it was intended for Gene Hackman. And I remember reading that Joe Don Baker could not get along with Peckinpah and wanted to like knock him down at one point, and Steve McQueen would always like calm the waters and just be like, that's just how he is. Just, you know, it's just a movie. This isn't real. Doesn't matter. I guess going to Steve McQueen, he has that habit of like, he knows that he is the star. He knows that he is Steve McQueen. But like, just like with Bullet, where he would give lines away so that he wouldn't have to say them and could just be silent and cool. And the more the more quiet he is, the more mystique he has. And you see everything that he's thinking on his face and in his eyes, and you understand every single aspect of his character, the way that he carries himself, with the way that he glances around, the way that he bites his lower lip or anything. And that's just like brilliant physical acting that I think we forget, that a lot of people don't give him the credit for. It's just like, oh, he's simply Steve McQueen. He is just effortlessly cool. And he is effortlessly cool. And he spent years working to create that identity. But he has it, and that work clearly pays off. I mean, there's a reason why going, you know, to the Towering Inferno, like, he steals it outright from Paul Newman and knows exactly what he's doing to steal it from him. He comes in the last 45 minutes, he saves the day and says very few lines, and Steve McQueen, you know, but you understand every single aspect of him with just how he is, how he brings himself physically to each role, even in The Blob, you know?
Oh, I know. I know. I agree with you. The funny thing is, I'm not one who's always been a big Steve McQueen fan. I enjoy his work, you know. And I enjoy what he does. But I'm not like oh, he's the bestest ever and that kind of stuff. And that's just everybody has different people they like for different reasons. But I still enjoy what he does, and I know what he's doing, and you can see it, and you could see he's just such a professional, such a pro. And yes, if he wanted to, he could steal scenes totally away from everybody, even if he's just in the background at the time. Ask Yul Brynner.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, who do you remember really in The Magnificent Seven? Steve McQueen.
Actually,
and he's got some competition there. He's got some major competition in that film.
I always remember James Coburn because, you know, you talk about another guy being cool.
Well, James Coburn is cool, but he's flashy cool. James Coburn knows how to, another Peckinpah regular, he knows how to spit out a line and do a sardonic glance and stuff, but McQueen barely does anything, and you're just, your eyes are glued to. I grew up watching many Steve McQueen movies, so I don't know, it's a little more instilled in me probably than it is with you, Steven, he's a born movie star also, and he knows everything. He knows exactly what he's doing. He's calculated everything, and he makes it look effortless. He makes it look spontaneous, which is always a huge trick of any actor. And he had a good relationship with Peckinpah. So Peckinpah allowed him that trust and freedom to do what he needed to do to get the best out of him, even if he's not saying a word and is in the back of the scene.
Because I believe when this film was done, and I think it was before it came out, they started to work on The Getaway.
Yeah.
Which of course ended up being, I think, the most successful film financially wise for both, right? Something like that, if I read right.
Yeah, yeah, because the hype around that movie was crazy.
This one was not the financial success. So it didn't even make its money back. So, you know, I don't know. I wouldn't call it a bomb, because to me a bomb is one that costs like tons and tons of money and makes very little. This just cost a few million and it made a couple million. So we're talking like a million difference. So yes, it was unsuccessful in the box office, but I would never call it a bomb. So, you know, everybody has different definitions for it. But later on, it was a movie that got rediscovered and people were like, oh, this is actually really good. And it is.
Yeah.
Really good.
Yeah, it is my favorite Peckinpah, I'd say. It is very stylized. It's a very different film from Junior Bonner. It is aggressive and violent and very sexy and stylized and totally different. But it's a fun, wild ride.
And these are the kind of movies that nowadays in my life I'm drawn to, where it's the slice of life type things. They call to me more. I still love the action movies. Don't get me wrong, people. You know, it's just, but the ones I think that have the roots with them are these, you know, like Will and Liz that you did, Michael Wirth's Appleseed, which I saw a few years ago, which is the best movie I saw that year. I don't know if you've ever seen it, but I highly recommend you see that movie. It's like this. That one's a buddy picture, but they're really nice when they're those slice of lives and they take things through it. And Will and Liz is another one. It's a relationship one. So they're different types of movies, but I think we all have those experiences where, you know, seeing The Expendables 4, none of us are ever going to experience that or come from any understanding of that. These things, we can see that this could be somebody we know or we do know, or it could be us in that type of role. And I think that's what's nice about these pictures, when you could put yourself in them. Already flashy? No. But it is definitely a movie that you can have anybody in the family watch and enjoy. Mm-hmm. Can't say that with many Peckinpah movies, but we can say that with this one. One thing we haven't talked about is the cinematography.
Mm-hmm.
Lucien Ballard was the cinematographer.
Lucien Ballard, yeah. Lucien Ballard. Old school Hollywood cinematographer. His list of credits is extensive. I believe he shot The Lodger from Daryl Zanuck back in 1944, and the way that he photographed Merle Oberon, they fell in love. Unless I'm totally getting all my Hollywood film history mixed up, but that's what's coming out, that's what's spurting to the front of my head. But Lucien Ballard, is also at the end of his game. I hate to say that, but he was by that point in his career and his age, and shoots it as fresh as John Coquillion would shoot Straw Dogs the following year for Peckinpah. How much of that is down to Peckinpah's dictates, or is it just because every filmmaker, having just worked with, I can only speak from my own experience. You know, a good amount of my films, I've been my own cinematographer. On Loon Lake, we had a cinematographer out of Minneapolis. On The Great Nick D, we had this other really great cinematographer here in Los Angeles. But I've noticed, you know, there's certain things that like overlap of style and composition and stuff between three different camera technicians. And so how much of it is just down to the directorial eye and dictate, and how much of it is brought by the DP himself. There's definitely a faded, I'm going to call it a faded glow to Junior Bonner that comes from Lucien Ballard's Hollywood studio system background and style. And it's perfect for the story of people at the end of their line. And I'm not going to call it fading Americana, but you know, this film is very much about tradition and the annual proceedings in Prescott that the film captures. We're looking at I'm gonna call it an idealized time of America that Peckinpah is capturing, and that Ballard's skill set feeds into that aesthetic, feeds into that mood. So even if you're like totally unaware of this and you're not even thinking about it while you're watching the movie, you're getting it on a subconscious level. There's moments of it where it's I said Robert Altman before, but like Nashville came to my mind when I revisited this movie, of we're seeing this slice of Americana. This is how things are, not so sarcastically and politically as it is in Nashville, but still like this is the way of life here. And it's a way of life that is rapidly fading post-Vietnam, or really Vietnam is still in its peak. Post-60s, post-hippie movement, America has changed from the way that Robert Preston and Ida Lupino and Sam Peckinpah were used to, you know, in their youth. The whole world is, and we're about to hit Watergate, where, you know, Reagan is not too far off, and Reaganomics fits in perfectly with Joe Don Baker's character, you know, greed is good. And so Lucien Ballard's, I just got on a crazy rant right here, but Lucien Ballard's photography just like hits that, like, this is a time that will never come again. That's a spoonful right there for me.
Well, I want to talk about something. I don't know if you notice this, I'm sure. I don't know if it's, I haven't read about it being talked about, but the coloring of the film is something nowadays you don't see as much. But the coloring, I think, you know, a lot of films nowadays are very colorful. Maybe it's because it's digital. Maybe it's because they're amping up certain colors.
But yeah, digital has a huge aspect, and this is, you know, it's 35 millimeter film, and it just has that texture and that fadedness. I don't know if he was flashing. I mean, going back to Altman again, like Altman and Vilma Siegman would flash the footage on McCabe and Mrs. Miller that same year to get a faded old photographic aesthetic. And this very much has that, especially in the opening rodeo scenes where everything is sepia toned, and it's just getting us into this is the past, but it's contemporary past, especially when the film first came out. Obviously, you know, we're now 50 some years after the film has been released, but it still has that, like, contemporary past, and that's with the color and the texture of the film itself. I think that's what you're getting at, Steve.
Exactly. And that's exactly what I was going for. And I find it so refreshing. It's like a palate cleanser when you watch a lot of modern movies. Then you watch this one, or a lot of the movies in the 70s. And I'm going to say it seemed to be more frequent. It was more of the norm. But this is the early 70s. So this, you know, still could have been one of more of the front runners before, you know, things became like, oh, it's all, you know, they've been doing it for 5 or 6 years now, so now it's the norm. And it's early on. You never know if it was influenced by other things or whether this was something that was on the cusp of the trend.